direction.
PRI's the world. It's your world.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. The big political news today means we are starting the program with a visit to the beauty shop. That's where our panel of women journalists and commentators take a fresh cut on the week's headlines. Sitting in the chairs for a new do this week are Professor Andra Gillespie. She's an associate professor of political science at Emory University. Bridget Johnson is Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media. That's a conservative libertarian commentary and news website. Connie Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and author of And His Lovely Wife, a memoir from the woman beside the man. And Alexis Wilkinson is a student at Harvard University. She is president of the Harvard Lampoon, the school's undergraduate humor magazine. She's also working as a journalist this summer. Welcome, ladies, to the shop. Good to hear from everybody.
Thanks for having
me. Hi, Michelle.
Great to be here.
Okay, that's great. So let me start with Professor Gillespie, because we wanted to talk about this political shocker that Republican Congressman Eric Cantor is out after a surprising primary defeat last night. He's the House Majority Leader, and he lost his district, his Virginia district seat, to Dave Brat, who is a Tea Party-supported political newcomer. He's also a professor himself. Here he is. This is Dave Brat after the victory.
The reason we won this campaign, there's just one reason, and that's because dollars do not vote. You do.
So, Professor Gillespie, this is, for people who don't follow this stuff closely, Cantor is being eyed as the next Speaker of the House, and our kind of political experts say that they can't remember a time when a person in that position lost the seat. So tell us your take on this. What do you think this was about?
This is utterly shocking, and I happen to be from the 3rd Congressional District in Virginia, which is right adjacent to that. So I grew up on the other side of the county from Eric Cantor, and I was shocked. I mean, there are a couple of things that we have to think about. I've been home twice in the last couple of months. I saw the ads. I didn't particularly like the attack ads against David Brat, particularly as a professor. So the idea that you use your expertise to help out the state, I thought it was completely unfair.
What was the point of the ad? What were they saying for those of
Eric Cantor tried to portray David Brat as a liberal, to try to say that he's really not a conservative. See, he helped Tim Kaine out by serving on, you know, as in an economic advisory position for the state. And so you had all of these sort of caricatures as David Brat as liberal college professor. See, support me. And I think there are two things. One, I think that evinced a certain sense of vulnerability because you rarely see ads for Eric Cantor in the district. He really hasn't had a competitive race since he won his initial primary to get into Congress in 2000. And I think the other thing that really kind of comes through it in looking at the election results broken down by county, David Brat and Eric Cantor happen to be both from the same part of Henrico County. Brat beat him in Henrico County, in his home base. He clearly beat him in Hanover County, where he teaches, and he just performed strongly throughout the district. Cantor wins Richmond City, but that's a small part of the district itself. So, I mean, this was a GOTV thing. Brat won because he did retail politics, and Cantor stayed on and was probably on television more than he should have been.
Okay, Bridget, what do you say about this? You know, one of the things that people are saying is that this is really puts the kibosh on immigration reform because Eric Cantor was moving to a position where you could actually get some legislation through. What's your take on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, every time that you tweeted something about Cantor last night, you get a reply, but he's an amnesty shill, you know, and I haven't really heard that sort of emotion since the mid-2000s with the censored Britter bill, et cetera. But it's confusing because Lindsey Graham won in South Carolina, and he doesn't even have to go to a runoff. He had 60 partiers challenging him, and he held firm to his guns on being one of the group of eight that put the immigration reform bill through. But so I think we're
so you don't really see a kind of a national issue here, because one of the things that people are interested in this is that a lot of people were saying, well, the Tea Party kind of has had its moment and come and gone. And so that's people are kind of drawing a big national conclusion from that. I think what you're saying is all politics is local. Maybe this is really about issues there in the district as opposed to and how Eric Cantor presented himself to his district as opposed to any big theme.
Well, I mean, I was talking to a person high up in Cantor's office just last week, and they said we're not worried about it. And I know a lot of other political reporters in town heard the same thing. Graham was worried about it. And because Graham was targeted early on as one of the people that they could take out. But, you know, the Tea Party is hit and miss. You know, it's been a movement based more on emotion than hardcore political strategy. You know, case in point is the primary challenge that was given to Speaker Boehner. And his opponent did like a Viagra-esque commercial banking on the mispronunciation of his name. And so you've gotten some very non-serious candidates. You've gotten some who've been able to wage these upsets, like Kanner last night. And it's surprising. I don't know if it's a trend that we're going to see, because, you know, we saw a lot of people come in 2010 that went out in 2012 because people in their districts realized, you know, wait, do you have what it takes to be a leader?
Interesting point. Connie Schultz, what do you think?
I've been all over the map on this in the last 12, 14 hours because so many journalists got this wrong. So many reported based on the polling they were given. And I'm wondering what pollsters are going to make of this, because they were either really, really wrong or somebody was lying throughout it. It's coming from Ohio, where Boehner is, who's considered always to be just unbeatable. I think one of the big lessons I'm hearing, I've been interviewing some activists this morning out of Virginia, Democratic activists, because when I first got up, I thought, I wonder if a lot of Democrats crossed over in this open primary. The analytics are not bearing out on that. Certainly some of them did. Perhaps a couple thousand did, but that wasn't enough for the 11-point lead. What it does tell me, though, when I talked to some of the Democratic activists this morning trying to make some sense of this, is you got two groups who feel disenfranchised so often in the mainstream coverage and in mainstream politics right now, and that's people on the left and people on the far right, the far left, far right. I hate that people who are pro-woman tend to be classified as left. I don't quite understand why that should be a leftist issue, but it is right now. So I'm wondering if this means their voices are going to be heated in a way they haven't been before, because nobody called this right, including the Cantor campaign.
You know, that's true. In fact, there was a story in the paper saying that he was actually at what I call my Northern office Starbucks, while his while his voters were casting their ballots, he was at Starbucks meeting
with people.
So, don't tell people you're at Starbucks. If you're just joining us, we're in the beauty shop. We're talking about this week's political news and hot topics. We're talking with Connie Schultz, that's who was speaking just now, Andre Gillespie, Bridget Johnson, and Alexis Wilkinson. So let's turn to another big political story of the week. Hillary Clinton's new book, Hard Decisions, hit shelves Tuesday. But earlier this week, she sat down with Diane Sawyer. She talked about Benghazi, Monica Lewinsky, and about what she said were she and the former president's financial trouble, saying that once they left the White House in her stint as first lady, that they were dead broke. And she later clarified her dead broke comment, saying, quote, "I fully appreciate how hard life is for so many Americans today. We have a life experience that's clearly different in many dramatic ways for many Americans, but we've also gone through some of the same challenges many people have," unquote. So, Alexis, I'm sure that you just finished classes, and so probably the last thing you want to do is crack open a major tome like this. But I am interested in how this is striking you. How is all this striking you?
I haven't, because of what you just said, I haven't finished the book yet, but I watched the interview, and I'm really looking forward to the 2016 election, and I think just, she was so, in that interview, so sharp. I mean, Diane went so hard on her on Benghazi, and even on the age thing and her health. I thought, I was watching that, like, wow, she's really going to do this, but Clinton just came right back and was like, oh yeah, isn't it great to be our age? And I just thought that was so funny, and I think, you know, To really challenge her, you're not going to be able to be smarter than she is, so you're going to have to come at her with something crazy. And I think, you know, right now, Eric Cantor's, upset being an example of, like, Republicans have plenty of crazy up their sleeves. So I'm just, you know, sitting with the popcorn, just ready to see how it all shakes out. I'm excited. It's going to be good.
Connie, what do you make of the whole thing so far, of the attack lines being directed at her, how she handled the interview? How is that all striking you?
I watched the interview late last night, and I was struck. I was reminded of what Karl Rove tried to do a few weeks ago, and I remember tweeting this out, that he was calling into question her brain power, and I said that's going to so work for him. And today, or this interview, and the conversation she's having this week, to me illustrate she is back and she is strong. That she can also be so tone deaf that even the apology, sort of, for what she said about income disparities, I wish she had just said, wow, was that a stupid thing for me to say, an insensitive thing for me to say, because they're in a different stratosphere for most Americans, and you may as well just own that. I think she seems very direct. Her book is boring so far, from what I can tell, and I expected it to be boring. I mean, I appreciate policy. I appreciate that she's been in the thick of it all, but I knew she was not going to set off any bombs in that book. So the challenge then for reporters, you can see it for interviewers, is how do we get her going? How do we spark that other conversation? Because as she made clear in her book, she wasn't going to gossip. Well, good luck with that.
Good luck with that. Professor Gillespie, is it hurting your feelings as a political science professor to hear people talk about this as boring? Or are you just like, yeah, kind of?
No, I mean, people say that political scientists can't write, so that's normal. for me, so it's okay. One of the things that kind of struck me, I picked up the book yesterday, and I've been observing elections up here in New Jersey this week, so it's been hard for me to get through it. But one of the things I did was I read the first few pages, and then I made sure to look at the pictures. And I think that Hillary Clinton has had a couple of problems. She has had a problem of feeling warm and empathetic towards people. And then she also has to deal with sort of the challenge of kind of being a trailblazer and being a woman running for such a high-profile office. And I looked at the pictures in Hard Choices versus the pictures in Living History, and it seems like she's trying to appear like she's leaning in. So to try to take the zeitgeist of the day of women sort of taking their opportunities and making the most of them, and to make herself look presidential, so almost that ready-to-lead mantra that she tried to use in 2008, thinking that she may have kind of already sort of softened her edges a little bit and come across as more personable. That's why I think the houses issue is a problem, because, you know, when I heard that, I was like, oh, your life must be so hard. You had trouble getting together down payments for two mansions. Oh yeah, my life is so like that.
Yeah, she did say that. She said, well, you know, we had to have mortgages, you know, we needed mortgages for houses.
Oh, yeah, we've all seen the houses.
Every time that's extra S, it's that extra, remember with Dan Quillen misspelling potato, it's that extra letter that just gets you, you know, every time, you know. Note to self.
And we saw the pictures, so we know that they're not little split-level ranches or nice little bungalows that they, you know, were struggling to pay for. So, you know, that's still going to be a problem with her. I mean, I've heard other Democratic commentators say, and I have to somewhat agree, this is not the Mitt Romney 47% comment. I don't think she's going to have that issue. It's just a question of actually being able to balance her humanity with being able to demonstrate that as a woman, she's capable to lead on all of the issues, and that, you know, she should be the one, as the wife of a former president, to break this glass ceiling for women.
All right. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this Beauty Shop roundtable with our panel of women journalists and commentators. We also want to talk about a recent op-ed about campus sexual assault that has a lot of people talking. So we're going to talk about that and more on Hillary Clinton and other stories of the week just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Brad Meltzer is a best-selling thriller writer, but when he wanted to write about the biggest, most heroic adventures he could think of, he turned to children's literature.
To my daughter, Amelia Earhart isn't some black-and-white figure from a history book. Amelia Earhart is alive, and she's brave, and most important, she's fun.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays, starting at noon on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We are continuing our discussion with our Beauty Shop panel of journalists and commentators. Andra Gillespie, Bridget Johnson, Connie Schultz, and Alexis Wilkinson are with us. Bridget Johnson, I just wanted to ask you briefly about your take on Hillary Clinton and the rollout of the book and the storylines that are emerging around her assumed presidential candidacy so far, not announced, but that seems to be where things are going.
I am looking forward to watching said phantom candidacy that we all know is going to happen, because the way her strategy is unfolding, you know, she wants to break from the Obama administration. She was trying to put distance between her and Obama, but she also was not trying to put much effort into winning over some of her hardest critics, for example, on Benghazi. So, and I noticed how she was also taking blame for the 2008 campaign strategy, which was interesting because as if the Clintons ever had had a problem with strategy in the political arena. But I see this as a signal that she wants to bring down any perception of demographic barriers and aim for a wider swath than she had before. She's not going to be just a women's candidate, and she wants to grab the voters who came out for Obama.
I just have a really super quick question for Connie, and I'm curious about, well, maybe Professor Gillespie, this is for you, but briefly, if you would, the racial politics of this. I mean, it seems like we're not really talking about that, but other people are talking about that. I'm thinking about, you know, Congressman James Clyburn's book, memoir, The Number Three Democrat in the House, opens with this encounter where he has President Clinton, former President Clinton, calling him at 2 a.m. to complain about how he felt Hillary was being treated. And that became kind of a racial thing. It had a racial tone to it. And then she says that, you know, in her discussion in the book, she says that she let the President Obama know that the preposterous charge of racism against Bill was particularly painful. And Barack made clear that neither he nor his team believed that accusation. But some people do. And I just wonder whether she's, you know, how is she handling that so far?
Well, so far, I mean, I think it's been handled pretty well, and I doubt it will be much of an issue unless there's a prominent black candidate running against her. I mean, Bill Clinton is going to have to own that some of the things that he said did sound mildly racist in 2008. And so long as he's aware of that and doesn't make those missteps again, I don't think that that's necessarily going to hurt Hillary Clinton's chances among African Americans. Is she going to get the same type of stratospheric support and perhaps the same high turnout? Well, she will if she asks for the vote and cultivates that constituency and canvasses there. But if not, she'll get the same typical support that most blacks give Democratic candidates, which we could expect to be somewhere about 90%.
Which is not small. So,
right.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about something that's gotten a lot of discussion in social media. There's been a lot of talk about campus sexual assault in recent weeks. The White House has assembled a task force to look into this, including a lot of high-level attention to it. We've talked about this on the program. Now, Washington Post columnist George Will, he's also a Fox News contributor, weighed in on the subject in an op-ed that upset a lot of people. He says that a lot of the discussions around sexual assault allow women, young women, to cry rape when really the issue is that they've made sexual decisions that they later regret. And he's also very critical of the Academy. He says for not kind of standing up against what he feels is kind of overreaching, you know, federal overreaching. There are a number of issues there. But I wanted to ask, Alexis, I'm going to start with you on this because, you know, there are obviously people who turn back and say that really what you're engaging is victim blaming. This, we've seen this movie before, and what you're saying is nothing new, and your attitude is exactly the one we're trying to counteract. But what do you say about this?
I mean, the man puts sexual assault in quotes. Like from the beginning of reading that piece, I knew what I was getting into, and I think it's only really notable because of its like lack of nuance and compassion and sort of, you know, it's the same like it's the same sort of thanks Obama victim blaming rhetoric that is so I'm fatigued of it, honestly, like conservative white male thanks Obama rhetoric. I'm over it. And it doesn't surprise me anymore. And I think just sort of railing against progressivism. And what particularly struck me about the piece, though, was the example that he used of I guess, the sort of like preposterous, in quotes, rape charges that are being brought up now, where, you know, a girl says no to having sex and then like falls asleep and then like doesn't say no again when the guy tries again, even after she said no the first time. And I want, when people sort of use those sort of examples, it makes me so mad as a student and as someone who has friends who have been sexually assaulted and as a person who's been put into sexually coercive situations. I just don't understand how like no does not mean no, like how many, you know, that no means no and that like crying means no and no response means no. I mean, why would you want to have sex with someone who doesn't actively want to have sex with you? Like, just go take a shower, like go figure it out. But like it's male entitlement and it's very, very basic level. And it's I'm at my wit's end with sort of dealing with that stuff.
Audrey, now you say you disagree with Will's, the core of his argument, but you said he did have one point. What was that?
I mean, I do think that younger people today have a very skewed example of what political correctness is and what healthy dialogue is. And so I want to create a safe space for people to be able to coexist who have extremely liberal and extremely conservative views. So they should all have a chance to talk into dialogue without being viewed as bigoted. So, you know, that being said, the New York Times talked about this yesterday when they were talking about evangelical student groups and sort of the challenges that they're having on campuses now, trying to live out their doctrine in, you know, the midst of non-discrimination clauses. But when it comes to sexual assault, I just thought George Will was completely tone deaf. The example that he uses was clearly an example of rape. The woman said no. So yeah, it was stupid that she was spooning with this guy, but she said no, and that's all that matters. And the idea that he was incredulous to the idea that somebody who is impaired by drugs or alcohol can't give consent, You know, I just, that blows my mind. I mean, it kind of shows his age. It kind of shows how not with it he is. And I, you know, wonder, like, what do the women in his life feel that they feel about these kinds of statements? And are they going to try to educate him so that he can be more sensitive in the future?
Well, what was the one thing you agreed with?
Nothing on the sexual assault part. Yes, nothing on the sexual assault part, but yes.
He should be allowed to give his wrong opinions. Is that the part that you agree with?
He should be allowed to give his wrong opinions, and I have the right in dialogue to be able to say, I think you're really, really wrong, and you might want to consider that other side. But yes, I think extremely liberal and extremely conservative people should not have speech codes imposed upon them just because somebody else is offended by what they say. Just because somebody is offended by what they say doesn't mean that you can't have a respectful dialogue. And I think younger people, my students in particular, sometimes have a harder time with difficult dialogues because they expect that at the end we're all going to agree, and we're not. And we just have to learn how to manage that.
Connie, can I brief word from you on this, if I can, because I'm interested in your take on this, both as a parent of daughters and also as a right. mother of daughters who are old enough to be confronting, you know, this whole question of ambiguous consent and whether it's really,
because right.
I think part of what he's saying is, look, you know, you have to take some responsibility for yourself. You know, what do you say?
As if women don't. I want to say something about his. I do not give him a pass on age. I do not give him a pass on gender. I don't care how old he is or how long he's been a man. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and should be adhering to the standards required to hold that honor. And that means if you don't know what women are thinking about this, you go talk to women. If you are so out of touch as to convey a status of, quote, privilege, that claiming that women have been able to claim that status because they've become victims, you are so out of touch with how journalism should be practiced, let alone what women are experiencing on campuses. And yes, I am a mother. We have three daughters and a daughter-in-law in our family, and I went from 0 to 100 in the time it took me to read that paragraph of George Will's, in case there was any doubt where I stand on this.
There isn't. Okay, before we go, I'm just going to steal just two more minutes. Bridget, forgive me, I'm going to pass you by on this because I just wanted to ask. We're going to hear from the co-founder of Essence Magazine in a minute. And Essence Magazine is in hot water over the July cover because it features the cast of the upcoming romantic comedy Think Like a Man 2. The movie has a predominantly black ensemble cast, but the magazine chose not to include the movie's white stars in their cover. And I was curious about how people feel about this because, you know, if we've made such a big deal out of the fact that, you know, Vanity Fair and previous issues, for example, has not showcased African Americans in Hollywood. They did, you know, in current issue. Bridget, do you mind if I ask, does this hurt your feelings? How do you feel about it?
Well, I mean, as a very palest, whitest of the white person, you know, I'm not actually offended by it. But I think that it would also be an opportunity to showcase racial harmony. And if you think that Vanity Fair and other magazines aren't doing a good job of that, then you could take the lead and you could set the standard.
Hmm. Alexis, what do you think?
I think, you know, obviously, as you said, magazines aimed at white audiences routinely exclude black actors, even when they are the star of the show. They'll do the side actor or the sidekick or something rather than focus on the main person. And Essence was created with that injustice in mind, so I understand totally why they did it. That being said, they included everyone but the white actors, and the cast is already so big that I think if they just included a couple like white faces, it wouldn't have, you know, disturbed the visual message or the dogmatic message of, you know, being a black magazine they're trying to send. And, you know, the way they did it does make it seem more of like an intentional snub because the cast is so big, but I totally understand why they did it, and, you know, I'm not offended, or I don't think people should be offended.
You don't. Okay. All right. Well, we'll see if anybody's offended and we'll have to call and hear them. All right. Sorry, ladies. We don't have a chance to hear from everybody on this, but thank you all. Alexis Wilkinson is a student at Harvard University. She is president of the Harvard Lampoon, and she joined us from WGBH in Boston. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University. She was with us from member station WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. Connie Schultz is a Pulitzer Prize winning columnist with us from member station WCPN in Cleveland, Ohio. And Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media, a conservative libertarian commentary and news website. She joined us in Washington, D.C. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Love your show.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Detroit, where the city's effort to come back from bankruptcy just got a boost. The big three automakers, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, have put down some serious financial muscle to help save the Detroit Institute of Arts, the DIA, $26 million to be exact. That could help save the city from having to sell the art to satisfy creditors. It's not just art admirers who are keeping their eye on this deal. People from retirees worried about their pensions to the creditors Detroit owes could be affected by this. We wanted to find out more, so we've called Rochelle Riley once again. She's a writer and columnist with the Detroit Free Press, with us from WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Also with us, Quinn Kleinfelter, senior news editor for WDET, with us from their studios. Welcome back to you both. And Quinn, I'm just going to jump right in. Tell us about this grand bargain. What does it do?
Well, it's something that's trying to prop up the pension system that has really been in trouble in Detroit and is at one of the cruxes, actually, in the bankruptcy proceedings. And, as you say, try to save the artworks from the Detroit Institute of Arts, which are very lucrative and which a lot of the creditors that Detroit owes money to, that as it goes through the bankruptcy proceedings, say you ought to sell that and help try to pay us off. This agreement between the state and some private foundations came together to say, well, we will soften the blow to these pensioners, and therefore you won't have to sell the artwork to try to soften the blow through that. And so the car companies are putting in this money as a portion of that. It's a portion of the art, the museum itself, that has to raise part of this so-called grand bargain. It's $800+ million. Also, the state's got some money in that they just had approved through a vote in the legislature that was a little bit contentious for a while, but then they all came together at the end. And so it's all trying to come together to preserve this art, and people were praising it. Although, you know, it is really a fairly small amount compared to how much the overall bankruptcy is. But in terms of what it can mean for the artwork and for the pensioners, it's very significant.
Hmm. Rochelle Riley, we've been coming to you from time to time to just get the temperature of things, of how people are reacting to these various moves. Give us your sense of how this is being received.
Well, as we always talk about, there are two Detroits, and the Detroit that wants this to work are celebrating that everybody's participating, everybody's sort of putting some money in. As Quinn said, the auto industry donation is only $26 million. To put "only" in front of $26 million sounds terrible, but when you're talking about $816 million, it's a small amount, but it signifies that they're a part of it. So there's this coming together. But then you've got the actual pensioners, some of whom are living week to week, who don't like this deal. They don't think that the bargain is a bargain for them, and a lot of them don't plan to vote for it. And it does have to be approved by two classes of pensioners, the police and fire pensioners who are in one class, and the general retirement pensioners, the other city employees, former city employees in another class. And both of those groups of people have to approve this. So we're a long way from done.
Does this, Rochelle, does this do anything to intervene in this narrative of feeling as though all is lost? When we last spoke with you, there was just a lot of sadness, as you would imagine, around so many of these issues, and it just seemed like the bad news was unrelenting. Does this intervene in that at all? Does it give people any sense of hope, even if it is a relatively, it sounds big, but it is actually a fairly small amount in the big scheme of things?
It actually does. I can tell you what a difference several months makes. There's a new mayor, Mike Duggan, who has made a lot of changes in the city that have helped to not just appease but to provide some sense of relief for residents who have felt very put upon. You know, there were 25 parks that were being maintained, you know, 6 months ago, and there's now more than 200. And some of the lights are on in the city, whereas, you know, a lot of the lights were off and it was dark at night. So there are some very practical things that are happening. And quite frankly, for some of the pensioners, they initially were talking about, you know, cuts as high as 25% of their pensions. And it is much lower now because of this. And emergency manager Kevin Orr has made it clear that the deal is not going to get better than this. The people who are holding out hope that it might be, you know, there might be more money somewhere, or there might be something better if they do reject this, he's made it clear that it's not. So for some folks, they really are glad that they did change that cut, so that it's not, you know, a quarter of their pension and them having to make a decision between medicine and food, but something much smaller. So the grand bargain has brought in a lot of money that didn't exist.
Quinn, take the last word here, if you would, and just give us a concluding thought, whatever you think we should be thinking about next as we watch this, you know, important story unfold. What's coming along?
Well, two aspects, probably. The first is there will be a confirmation hearing, which just got delayed until mid-August with the creditors, where they will bring up all their reasons that they oppose this happening and a lot of problems that they see with it. They stand to lose hundreds of millions of dollars of people that loaned money to Detroit and are not going to get it back. The pensioners are pretty much up against it, although there are a fair amount of unions that say they're going to try to fight the deal as well because they don't think that it's going to really help them. And then, as Rochelle says, the city in very many ways is kind of two cities. And there are people in the outer ring neighborhoods that say they don't feel the investment coming into the downtown or the midtown areas, and they fear that they're being left behind. And along with all that, there's other cities teetering on bankruptcy or being crushed by similar pension obligations that are watching what happens in Detroit and seeing if that's what the path can be that they can follow to get out from under their obligations.
That was Quinn Kleinfelder. He's the senior news editor for member station WDET. Also with us, Rochelle Riley, columnist for the Detroit Free Press. It's good to talk with both of you once again. Please keep us posted. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, for decades, Essence magazine has documented the beauty of black women, even when others were slow to see it.
For me to see Lupita now being shown as one of the most beautiful women in the world, I can remember when black women were thought of in 1970 as uncouth, loudmouth, unfeminine, poor, and couldn't read.
A co-founder and former top editor of Essence take us back in their new book, The Man from Essence. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation, proud supporter of StoryCorps, sharing stories of new citizens. More at greatimmigrants.carnegie.org. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. From LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves target bank and savings accounts of victims. Learn more at lifelock.com, code NPR. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
I've got the key to the highway.
Brothers Phil and Dave Alvin, formerly of the Blasters, have recorded their first album together in about 30 years. It features songs by bluesman Big Bill Brunzi. On the next Fresh Air, the Alvins perform in our studio, tell us how they first discovered the blues, and we talk about Phil's recent near-death experience. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items that are organic, recycled, or biodegradable, like pet accessories, travel mugs, and water bottles. More information can be found at trophytime.com. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies.
When Eleanor Longdon got to college, she started to hear voices.
And they don't sound like me, so some of them are male, some of them sound quite young, some of them have different accents.
And they would drive her crazy, until she started talking back to them.
The voices have ultimately become partners in that healing process.
I'm Guy Raz. Stories of Overcoming, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturdays at 3 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Summer is upon us, and so it's time for our regular summer reading series. Now, often when we think about books for this season, we think about beach-ready novels with adventure or romance. But since this year marks the 50th anniversary of many pivotal events in the civil rights movement, this summer we decided to dive into books that explore the theme of freedom. And if you follow media, then you probably know that there's been an ongoing debate about whether this country's media offerings in any way reflect the diversity of the country. Now, though, we want to go back to 1969, when faces of color were few and far between doing any job in major media. That was the year an unlikely group of businessmen and salesmen decided to create a magazine specifically targeted to black women. They called that magazine Essence, and today it is a coffee table staple in hundreds of thousands of African-American households and businesses. While Essence has undergone many changes over the years, including a controversial sale to Time, Inc. in 2005, it is still a place where black women can turn to see diverse images of themselves, read about their most pressing concerns, and see the latest trends in beauty and fashion. But the road to making Essence was filled with more drama than you might imagine. Now, a new book by Essence co-founder Edward Lewis and the magazine's former executive editor Audrey Edwards tells those stories. Edward Lewis and Audrey Edwards, the co-authors of The Man from Essence, are both with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Lewis, I'm going to start with you. There are a lot of poignant and kind of surprising stories in the book, but I think the biggest surprise for many people might be that the idea for Essence, a magazine targeted at black women, was started with four men who had no experience in journalism or publishing. So I have to ask, where did the idea come from?
Indeed. One of the reasons why I wrote the book is to demonstrate to black women that four black men cared about them, cared about their history, their beauty and intelligence, and we wanted to bring something into the world that they would ultimately feel good about. And so we started on this journey back in 1968, 69, with an idea to create a magazine for black women. At the time, there were the other women's magazines like Cosmo or Harper's Bazaar, Elle or Red Book or Ladies' Home Journal. They were not talking about the aspirations and beauty of black women. And so we thought that this was a void in the marketplace, that we could fulfill that niche.
Well, you know, it's both a personal story and a business story, and I do want to get to some of the business side of it, but I was interested in the fact that the void also included women on your management team, which led to some kind of disastrous early decisions, including the first name, which was proposed, which was Sapphire, which was hated by all of the women to whom you mentioned it. You want to talk about that?
We were looking at a variety of names, and we thought that Sapphire, the real meaning of a sapphire is a precious jewel and strong. And we wanted to say to black women that you're precious and strong. And Sapphire, you know, emanates from the old Amos and Andy show that was started in 1932 at two black men and one black woman. The black woman was called Sapphire. So anytime any black woman was, when she was called Sapphire, that was a put down. She was uncouth, loud-mouthed, unfeminine. But as you know, we began to feel good about ourselves with the growth of the civil rights movement. And black became beautiful, and we just thought that black women were a true jewel and very precious. We did hold some focus group discussions with a number of black women, and they said, have you lost your mind? And why don't you think about another name? And fortunately, we listened, and the third editor of the magazine, a wonderful woman by the name of Ruth Ross, we're bouncing names off the ceiling, and she said Essence. And that collectively, my partners and I said, ah, that's what we should call the magazine.
So your focus group, though, included a lot of wives and girlfriends, as I understand it, because indeed, you really didn't have that kind of money, which leads me to my second question, which is one of the early challenges for Essence was securing funding, investments, and advertising, because a lot of people kind of dismissed the idea out of hand. They just did not believe that there was a market for this kind of thing. They didn't think black women would buy it. How did you deal with that?
We put a business plan together in which we were trying to raise $1,500,000, and when we had our first closing, it was only $130,000. And even before we got to the $130,000, if it had not been for a black bank in Harlem, started by Jackie Robinson, he started a bank called Freedom National Bank. The president of Freedom National Bank in 1969 loaned me $13,000. If he had not done that, I may not be talking to you now. Mm. We did close. We got $130,000. I immediately went to Chicago and had a meeting with Hugh Hefner of Playboy magazine. And Playboy made the investment, in essence,�¼ million. And so that was the genesis of how we got off the ground.
Audrey Edwards, let's turn to you. You were not part of the first editorial team, but you did join the staff fairly early on. As somebody who was just beginning your career, what made you want to work with this magazine? And do you remember what your feelings were about it when you first heard about it?
When I first heard about Essence, I was working at Redbook, and I was a secretary in the fiction department. I was 22 years old. The editor-in-chief had heard that this magazine was coming out for black women, and he was worried that the black women working at Redbook were going to be recruited. And I distinctly remember him coming in to me and saying, "Audrey, has anyone from Essence called you?" And I said, "No." And I said to myself, "They don't even know I'm here, but one day they will." And in 1981, I was working at Family Circle. I got a call after Susan Taylor had been made editor-in-chief. I got a call from Ed Lewis asking me to come to lunch. And I remember thinking, Ed Lewis knows I'm here. And I think for any black journalist, female, working at Essence is the height. I cannot imagine being black and being a journalist and not wanting to work at Essence.
A lot of people coming along today don't know what it's like to be in a world where you never saw your face on the cover of a magazine, particularly a magazine that featured fashion and beauty. Can you describe that, though, for people who don't remember?
Well, working at Redbook, where the editor-in-chief was very much into diversity, and it was wonderful from an employment standpoint, but I was in editorial and rarely saw black models in Redbook. I was in the fiction department. We occasionally published black fiction writers, but for the most part, I was editing a product for women who didn't look like me. There was a commitment to hiring, but you were working in these white settings where you did not see people in the product that you were editing. So Essence was very important to me personally and to me professionally.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Essence Magazine's co-founder Edward Lewis and former executive editor Audrey Edwards. We're talking about their new book, The Man from Essence. It tells the story of the founding of Essence Magazine, which is this country's premier editorial outlet for African-American women. You know, there were a lot of conversations, some of which persist, Mr. Lewis, today, about what the magazine's editorial vision should be. And I wanted to ask about that. As I understand it from the book, I mean, Gordon Parks, the famed photographer, was Essence's first editorial director, and he felt the magazine should be focused on fashion and beauty. And the first editor-in-chief, Ruth Ross, whom you mentioned, who named the magazine, and aren't you glad she did, thought that the magazine should deal with more hard-hitting topics. Can you talk about that?
We did start out as a one-dimensional concept in terms of being a fashion magazine, but we quickly realized that the black woman is multidimensional and she's got a wealth of needs and information. And so we evolved into a lifestyle women's service magazine that tries to cover the totality of what it is to be a woman and specifically to be a black woman.
You know, to that end, though, I have to ask about this because these are all things that you write about in the books. Essence was notorious at one point for only using white photographers. The first executive editor, which is the role you eventually took over, was also white, and a lot of people would be surprised, I think, to find that out.
There was not a large pool of black talent to choose from in 1970, and Ed is very clear about saying we wanted to put out the best product possible, and to do that, we needed to hire talent who could train black talent to put out the best product.
Please understand, in those early days, we really thought that we would have an all-black staff, all-black everything, but the reality hit us quite quickly with regard to trying to find people to fulfill those positions, particularly back in 1970 and 1971.
Mr. Lewis, I have to tell you, you've got this very level kind of airline pilot voice, you know, where you feel like nothing would ruffle your feathers. But the book is filled with these really dramatic, I mean, there were all kinds of drama at this place. I mean, two of the original partners were ousted from the group. You went through seven editors-in-chief over a very short period of time. Why was there so much drama, do you think, at that time?
Well, I think particularly in the early stages of in the formation of a company, we had four partners. We really did not know each other when we first met. We were equal partners, equally making a decision about how to run a company. That is, in my opinion, a prescription for a disaster. And so ultimately we had to select a person who's going to be the person that's going to either say yay or nay in terms of the direction of the company. And even when we amongst ourselves, my partners, decided that I would be that person, it still created issues with respect to the partnership. So I asked one of the partners to leave in 1971, another to leave in 1974, But remarkably, the remaining partner, Clarence Smith, and I were together for almost 32 years. That in and of itself was rather extraordinary.
I wanted to ask Audrey Edwards, we started talking about how, what role this magazine plays in the lives of so many people who have few other outlets, at least especially when the magazine started, but did not see themselves reflected in the major media, at least especially not in a positive way, right? In terms of wearing the latest fashions, being elegant, doing amazing things. How do you think working at the magazine changed you?
One of the things it did for me was show me what was possible. I actually went into real estate after I went to work at Essence, and one of the things that happened to me was on a regular basis, the magazine was profiling women who had started their own businesses, who were their own women, were entrepreneurs, like the four young men who started Essence, and I saw what was possible because we were writing about these women every month.
Mr. Lewis, you eventually sold Essence to Time, Inc. in 2005, and there are criticisms of that move to this day. There are those who say that there's no way that a corporate owner like Time is going to really respect the full dimensions of the audience or really even understand it. What do you have to say about that?
I began to realize, being on one company magazine, that headwinds were out there with regard to continuing pressures on costs, paper, printing, people. And I wanted to make sure that Essence will continue to empower black women, that it's going to be sustainable for years and years to come. One of the reasons why I sold the magazine to Time, because Time cared about brands. They cared about this audience. This audience was underserved. And the editorial mission of Essence has not changed under the leadership of Time. I've often said, when you begin to see white women on the cover or white women in the magazine of Essence, then black women should stop buying the magazine.
What would you want people to draw from this book?
I do believe that because of the family that I come from, being around by my grandmother, my mother, my aunts, they were my heroes, and looking at how they were viewed as mothers, as workers, they were not appreciated. And so for me to get involved with a magazine that would celebrate and tell the story of black women was something very, very meaningful. And for me to see Lupita now being shown as one of the most beautiful women in the world. And I can remember when black women were thought of in 1970 as uncouth, loudmouth, unfeminine, on welfare, poor, and couldn't read. And to see the evolution in terms of how black women are viewed today, how Madison Avenue now views black women in terms of their buying power, it brings a quiet joy to me to know that I've had something to do with helping black women feel very, very good about themselves.
Edward Lewis and Audrey Edwards are the authors of The Man from Essence. It's a new book about the founding of Essence magazine, and they were both kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Edward Lewis, Audrey Edwards, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Finally today, another of my sad but true stories. A while back, I was working on a lengthy television documentary with a colleague who was a very experienced producer, a veteran of many lengthy and complicated projects. In other words, she knew what she was doing. We'd gotten to the final edit stage of a project where we were going back over a story that had been huge news at one point, but about which there had been a lot of misinformation. And one of the things we were trying to do with our piece was correct the record. Well, for some reason, one of the other producers assigned to help us get on the air kept putting a line in the script that we knew from our reporting was not true. And we kept taking it out, and she kept putting it back in. And finally, my colleague said to her, "Look, do you want the truth, or do you just like your story better?" Can I just tell you, this is what comes to mind often as I see stories in the news and I hear people opining about them and repeating things which even a little bit of effort would show are not true. I was also thinking about this because I came across some refreshing new research by Howard University psychology professor Ivory Toldson. He's currently working on a White House initiative about historically black colleges and universities. Toldson is very interested in the whole question of academic success among school-aged black males, and one of his projects is debunking what he says is the myth that black boys don't care about education. He says, in a piece reported last week in the Washington Post, that research on black boys in Washington, D.C. suggests that their desire to go beyond high school actually exceeds that of white boys. He also wrote in a lengthy piece for the online publication The Root that the often stated notion that more than half of black males drop out or do not graduate is not true, unquote. He says that this number does not account for boys who graduate early or late, state or transfer schools or obtain a GED. And all of that complicates the overall picture. But Tolson had another point, which was this, that this representation of a crisis scenario too often leads to extreme and unhelpful solutions, including a dumbing down of the kinds of educational opportunities that are often directed to Black boys. Not to mention an ongoing stigma that even the most motivated and excellent students have to fight. He says this refusal to look at the data closely, to prefer a story over the facts, creates more problems than it solves. Now, of course, there are those who quarrel with Tolson's view of what is true, and they did so in the comments section of the Roots piece. But it was telling to me how many reverted to the everybody knows this about that argument and didn't bother to take seriously the question of whether the way we talk about Black boys is itself part of the problem. Now, Professor Tolson has sparked controversy before for being too concerned about stigma and less about substance. For example, he suggests that the low marriage rates among African Americans has more to do with the high cost of housing and wage stagnation in the cities where Blacks tend to live than it does with any cultural aversion to marriage. But it's worth noting how often stigma or stereotypes do affect substance. In fact, sometimes create substance. Recently, for example, we've been learning more and talking more about the effects of stereotypes on groups like women and Asian Americans. For example, women are often presumed to lack technical or math skills even when they have them. And Asians are often presumed to have technical skills even when they don't. It doesn't take a genius to see how these attitudes can distort opportunities for some and unfairly advantage others. And how even an advantage at one point in life can become an albatross at a different one, when we look, for example, at why some people are considered leaders and others are not. Still, it seems to me that people like Professor Tolson, who desire to shed new light on old issues, should be applauded. So a good question to ask as this school year winds down and we begin to plan for another one is, are we really interested in tapping everyone's full potential in our schools and workplaces, or do we just like our story better? And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.